Welcome to the Anti-Woke Podcast. Let's roll. Here's a clip of the president of the University of Pennsylvania being questioned by Representative Elise Stefanik about anti-Semitism on campus.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer yes, Ms. McGill. So is your testimony that you will not answer yes?
If the speech becomes conduct, it can be harassment. Yes.
Conduct meaning committing the act of genocide?
There's been some fun criticism of university presidents this week. The presidents of Harvard, UPenn, and MIT were hauled before Congress to talk about anti-Semitism on campus. Reminder, UPenn is Ivy League, not Penn State. And also, MIT, I think it's like two blocks away from Harvard. It's basically the STEM version of Harvard. But these three presidents were brought before Congress, and the clips that went viral were from, I think, Elise Stefanik is a Republican New York rep. And she's like, can't you say that calling for the genocide of Jews is not allowed on campus? And they did a bunch of weaseling with their words, saying that they support free speech and stuff. I mean, they've been anti-free speech for, I don't know, ever since Trump got elected and probably before that. But they're pulling it out now. Now that Jews are whites, you can call for the genocide of Jews. And I think they were surprised by the reaction, because the next day they all released videos walking it back with more weasel wording. And probably some both sidesism and some lies about supporting free speech. But what's fun about it is the three presidents, university presidents, they're all women. Obviously, a bunch of men were more qualified, you know, more capable men were passed over to choose these three women because they're women. The Harvard one's a black woman. So I guess even, you know, in her case, white women were also passed over, even though they were more qualified to hire her. I mean, it's only 99 out of 100 times that that's true. So anyways, it's definitely true this time. But here's the funny part. So I went and looked up how long each of these ladies has been the president of their university. Two of them got hired this year, and one of them got in there last year. So, you know, they've been in months or maybe slightly over a year. And, you know, they're like, I'm a woman, I can't be criticized. Little did they know that there was going to be this Israel-Hamas war, and they were going to step in it. And one way of looking at Harvard is that they're an index fund or a hedge fund. You know, they're an investment bank attached to a university. Like, Harvard graduates pay money to Harvard so that they can get their family into Harvard. And then Harvard takes that money and invests it. And I don't know, they're in the, I think they got hundreds of billions. They might be having trillions of dollars to throw around. I mean, they can pay for every student to have a free education if they want. They don't, I mean, they do pay for anyone who can't pay, they just pay for you. And then I think graduate students from overseas, they make them pay. That's about it. Well, plus medical and law school are not free. And I don't know about right now, but at one point, for instance, Harvard owned the second most amount of forest land of any organization in America. I mean, they're like BlackRock. They got so much damn money, they got to put it into everything. So they own companies as well as land and who knows what. I think they own a lot of oil company stock, and there's been calls for them to divest that sometimes. Anyways, who's the tail? Who's the dog? I don't know. I don't really think the investment fund controls Harvard that much, but we will see. And one of the main places Harvard gets their money from is Jews who graduate from Harvard. Now, young Jews are calling for the destruction of Israel and want to make Palestinians rule that land. But older Jews support Israel and want to not allow that. And they're the ones who are paying for it. You know, they're getting their niece in, but their niece ain't rich yet. So it'll just be funny if any or all of them get fired just months into their position where they thought that they were uncriticizable. I mean, basically it's bad timing. I think, you know, when they hired these ladies, they were like, you know, here, there's only two criteria that must be met for sure, and that's, are you a woman and are you racist against whites? Well, and there's a third criteria. Are you qualified enough so that we only have to do a medium amount of lying when we say that you are the most qualified person to be the president of this university? Like, we'll do, you know, a low amount of lying, a medium amount of lying. That's all good. We just don't want to do a fuck ton of lying when we say that you were the most qualified. But possibly this is one of those woke things that just sorts itself out. Because it reminds me of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, Marvel, Disney movies have been hiring women of color to direct their movies. And basically, it's right at the time when every Marvel movie sucks is when they brought in these women of color. I mean, the movies suck partly because the women of color are the directors and they're just not qualified for it. But it's also the same time when every other position on the movie is being selected for by race and gender and sexuality. So it's just kind of funny. All right, women of color, here's your chance. In a situation where you just cannot win, you're going to fall flat on your face instantly. And the clip went, you know, the clips of these ladies went around, and, you know, it gave Elon Musk the chance to go on Twitter and say, this anti-Semitism is intolerable. And Elon has been going on a tear against Disney this past week. Like, the guy works crazy long hours, famously sleeps at the factory when something new is being ramped up. But he also plays video games. Like, he has time to play these long-ass video games that take many hours to beat. And so I almost would not be surprised if he started a YouTube channel where he just started complaining about woke Disney on a daily basis. Or maybe a podcast talking about this exact same stuff I talk about. But Disney is the poster child for the advertiser boycott of Twitter, because Twitter's anti-Semitic, Elon's anti-Semitic. So he's been tweeting that all the shows on Disney Plus are unwatchable and Disney got woke and went broke. And he's been asking Bob Iger, the president of Disney, why he's advertising on, I think, Instagram and TikTok, which have higher levels of, I don't know, you know, child sexual abuse and anti-Semitism than Twitter. And I saw, I don't know, it was like the Secretary of State, someone in charge of the state of South Carolina, they're pulling all their money out of Disney. Like, you know, states have pensions where they invest in companies and stuff. And so the guy was saying, you know, they're doing an advertiser boycott against the only place in the world, Twitter, where, you know, working class people can have their voices heard. So it's a boycott of the boycott. We'll see if that goes any further, but it's fun. And reminder, so the ESG, the big index funds like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, they force companies to do woke stuff. And I think the reasoning is you make companies do stuff for climate change because that helps you with the politicians in Europe. And then you make, you know, you have all the white, straight white males fired. And you say it's because of diversity, but it's really so you can just put in your pawns who will do what you want. And for most companies, doing all this stuff doesn't affect the bottom line, but Disney is the prominent example, and it's hurting them, maybe, quite a bit. And U.S. states have maybe pulled some money out of BlackRock, and Vanguard has talked about putting less emphasis on ESG. I mean, they're all the man behind the curtain, so we'll see how it goes. I don't think they're not getting more woke. They're either staying the same or getting less woke. And, you know, everyone's got to be afraid of the Supreme Court possibly saying you can't discriminate on the basis of race, and is also afraid of Trump becoming president and having a competent staff that might You know, the DOJ might start investigating all these people for civil rights violations or who knows what. Fiduciary duty violations where it's costing you money to do climate change stuff. That's not allowed. You know, so maybe they tone it down and then if Biden wins, they redouble their efforts. I got some stats on Disney. In 2019, Disney had 7 movies that made over $1 billion each. This past year, they had 0 movies. Those movies added up to a loss of $1 billion. And that first number was box office dollars, which one of those dollars is not equal to a dollar. But the lost dollars are real dollars. And also, I looked up ESPN, and I think this is last year. Couldn't find this year. But they made roughly $15 billion gross, $4 billion net profit. And I think ESPN has the contract, you know, with the NFL. If you want to watch football or baseball or basketball, you know, you can't boycott ESPN. So I think that's why Disney's stock, even though all their movies are flopping, and that's kind of what you, when you think of Disney, you think of movies and parks. And maybe those two things can be boycotted, but they get money from elsewhere, so their stocks haven't totally crashed and can't crash. And these anti-Disney YouTubers that I watch, I think people who work at Disney sometimes watch their videos too. And so they kind of get leaks from workers who tell them what's going on behind the scenes. And you know, I think you just get DM'd on Twitter. It's hard to tell if someone's just making stuff up. But Chris Gore from Attack of the Show, doesn't matter if you've never heard of him, but he's in touch with people who work at Disney, and those people were saying that everyone who wasn't in line with wokeness has been let go, has been pushed out of Disney. So there's no one left who isn't part of that, who isn't super woke. And so they're just not going to be able to pivot. Even if you fire the people at the absolute top, which I think is what's going to happen, there's going to be some changes up there with people who are not woke. But if every single employee is woke, it's going to be very difficult. Actually, I don't know. I mean, you know, Disney's MO is they make a crappy movie and they put in a lesbian kiss. So it's very easy for the CEO to say, okay, just take out the lesbian kiss, right? That can be done. The question is whether or not all the employees are not qualified for their jobs. So you can't make good content, period. Doesn't matter taking out the lesbian kiss. Oh, and then to me, this seemed like super crazy bonkers. To a normal person, it probably wouldn't. Maybe it happens before. Anyways, the Marvels, the latest Marvel movie that flopped, Disney is no longer releasing box office numbers for it. Like, I've never heard of any company not releasing box office numbers prematurely. I don't know, because anyways, just period, for any reason. And so, I don't know, Disney is, they're coming under pressure and doing weird stuff. Or else maybe this is a normal thing that I just never heard of.
Gonna break in here and say that the University of Pennsylvania lady who was in that earlier clip has resigned.
Last week I was talking about how we know how to solve climate change, which you put sulfates into the upper atmosphere. And so I was telling someone about that, and I decided to go on the internet and see if what I was saying was true. And the answer is yes, it's completely true. And so NASA has a website that's, I don't know when they wrote it, a while ago, saying that, yeah, you can put sulfates in the air, it has a cooling effect. I mean, you know, they don't go into the politics of it, how Greta Thunberg would be distraught if you solve climate change. I mean, I think she's protesting Palestine stuff now, but she'd be distraught if you solved the Palestine situation too. So I'll put a link in the description if I remember. Otherwise, just you can look up the article. It's called Ask NASA Climate. And it's aerosols, small particles with big climate effects. You know what? It's from June. It's pretty new. Maybe it's only in the last year that we realized we can solve climate change anytime we want. But let me read just a tiny bit from it. Volcanoes emit sulfur dioxide gas. These light-colored sulfate aerosols block incoming sunlight. Mount Pinatubo's enormous eruption in 1991 is a recent example. The sulfates from the eruption cooled the atmosphere by 0.7 to 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit, half a degree Celsius, and made 1992 and 1993 the coolest years in the past 35 years. So there you go. We can solve climate change on a per year basis by replicating what that volcano did. Last week I mentioned it would cost $5 to $10 billion, which is a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of money we're wasting on a million things. And, you know, was there a catastrophe of people having too many sulfates in the air in 1991 and 92? Like, you know, my listeners are old enough. Do you remember some catastrophe? No, because there was no catastrophe. It was fine. And if we did it on purpose, it would be fine today. And so, you know, me hearing professors on podcasts saying we can solve climate change, NASA, that article, I mean, you have to read between the lines, but they're saying, you know, NASA feels free to say that we can solve climate change anytime we want, basically. So I think you're going to start hearing about it from other sources. I'm going to keep an eye out for that. But I bet you in the next year, everyone is going to read little articles or hear someone talking about how we can solve climate change. And I think the reaction, you know, initially would be like, wait, what did that guy just say? Well, I'll just go on with the rest of my week. But then at some point, people are going to be like, wait, what? We don't have to worry about that thing? The thing that the kids are freaking out about, the thing that everyone is, whatever. Anyways, we can solve climate change, and I think the general public is going to become aware of it in the next year. I mean, it might take a couple years. And I think politicians already know. I mean, if you have a staff, I would hope they would tell you. And so I think it's why politicians are always like, climate change is the worst thing ever. We're all going to die. And then they do nothing about it. And it's because they just want to get votes for climate change, but they know that it's not a problem, so they don't do nothing. And this is like only 2 years, I think, after I went on the record on this podcast saying that climate change is real. And I only got to enjoy the fact that we were all doomed for 2 years, and now it's already over. I'm feeling a little silly. I mean, I didn't go overboard with it, but there was 3 interactions from listeners on Spotify this week. Sexy Fingers said, the PC police restrict what I say here, so F you PC, keep it up. Anti-woke politicians around the world are slowly creeping in. Tell WEF and woke gov to F you. Not entirely sure on the acronyms there. I mean, I know what FU is, and I guess PC is politically correct. WEF, is that World Economic Forum? Could be. Not something I talk about much, but it might be that. But thank you, Sexy Fingers, for the comment. Chopper22 said, you'll never lose this listener. I'm in a semi-truck all day, and it helps kill the boredom. My favorite pod by far is I pick up lots of stats. Keep at it, and I'll tell all my buds to listen to this pod. Hey, thanks, Chopper22, and that's a good reminder, listeners. Tell your friends about this podcast. And then Dan said, Vegas shooter may have been white. Last name didn't fit, but he looks white. Love your show, man. Keep it going. And he had a little picture of a train. Oh, he's probably one of the train guys that listens to my podcast. Well, thanks, Dan. I will keep it going. And there was a variety of shootings this past week. Well, the last 2 weeks that I haven't been keeping up on it. There was 3 Palestinian college students, I think, like, moved here from Palestine, or I don't know. And they got shot by a white guy who, like, I think he was trying to, we don't know, but maybe he was trying to shoot Arabs. He didn't know that he got some actual honest-to-God Palestinians. Got lucky on that one, I guess. If he was doing it because of the, I mean, it wasn't a Jewish person. I don't know. Anyways, didn't make white men look very good. And then there was one in Vegas. Oh, that's right, a professor. That's kind of mixed messages. Anyways, a white man, but he was a college professor. He went on to the University of Las Vegas campus and shot some people. It was more of a going postal. Remember in the old days, you didn't have you didn't say mass shooting for everything. You had different kinds, I guess. Anyways, the main kind back then was going postal. So he had a list of people that he was looking for, and it was because they wouldn't give him a job. I mean, that's like going postal when the post office hasn't even hired you yet. And then a black lady tried to burn down Martin Luther King's childhood house or something. I think on the news they said, someone tried to burn down Martin Luther King's house. And I was like, I bet it's a black person, but I hope to God it isn't a white person. Anyways, turned out to be a black person, and so basically, who cares? We could have had some rioting, but the riots were vaporware at that point. Oh, and then one of them, that's right, a Muslim guy, I think from Iraq, I don't know, anyways, Middle Eastern Muslim guy who moved to America, shot a shotgun in the air outside a synagogue. And like I say, I'm just not paying close enough attention because I think on NBC Nightly News, which is my stand-in for all mainstream media, I think they were like, someone tried to burn down Martin Luther King's house. And they didn't say who did it. And I only know that it was a black woman because I looked it up elsewhere. So, you know, the average viewer of the show is like, well, must have been a white man. Those white men always trying to burn down Martin Luther King's house. And I think they said the words white male, or no, white man, for the Las Vegas shooter. And then the Muslim guy, they mentioned someone, I think, you know, it wasn't known the first day. Some guy shot a shotgun outside a synagogue. And I don't know if America, I don't know who America thinks did that. I can't remember if they talked about it in another segment. I mean, I think America is still under the false impression that white men commit mass shootings, even though it's 75 to 85% black men. But I think the public is waking up to the truth. And to be honest, these last couple weeks, it kind of was white men doing the shootings. And I do want to say, I appreciate the interactions because, so Spotify hosts my podcast and they tell me how many people listen to me. And, you know, like the last one, it was about 100 people. And I read somewhere that 80% of podcast listeners listen to the whole podcast. I mean, mine's kind of long, so I don't know if that applies to me, but basically Spotify's like, you know, maybe 3 months ago, Spotify's like 250 people are listening to you. And then now they're like 100 people are listening to you. And basically I have very little way or no, I have no way of verifying those numbers. But I don't think Spotify is making up the interactions when people write in and say stuff. Dan, are you real? Pinch yourself, Dan. But three interactions in a week, that's about as many as I've ever gotten. So maybe I'm doing great. It's hard to say. And it seems like, you know, the number that Spotify tells me has been going down a bunch about the same time as the Israel war. So maybe this is a problem that everyone's having that, you know, whatever you say, if you talk about the Israel-Hamas war at all, you're going to piss off maybe half, maybe not half, but, you know, a large segment of your audience because they feel one way or the other way. I don't know. And Slate Money was talking, the Slate Money podcast was talking about the state of podcasting, and it's up 40% year over year. I think the amount of people or the amount of time that people spend listening to podcasts, something like that. But there was a boom and a crash in podcasting, which is fancy podcasts that have like a whole crew of people paid, you know, yearly salaries to work on a podcast. I mean, think, well, they're saying NPR podcasts are doing okay. So, you know, if your podcast requires a whole bunch of people behind the scenes and you can put your podcast on the radio as well as have it be a normal podcast, then those podcasts are doing all right. But if it's one that's just a pure podcast, all the companies and the venture capital, all the money that was paying people to a whole, you know, paying a whole team of people to make a 1 hour a week podcast or whatever, those things are going the way of the dodo. No one's putting money into them anymore. They brought up the example of a podcast called Heavyweight, which I've never heard of, but apparently it was a very famous, well-received podcast that cost a ton of freaking money, and I think Spotify was paying for it, and it got canceled. And Serial was a famous podcast about a murder or something. I mean, he was in jail. He was in prison, but maybe he didn't do it. I don't know if Serial is still going, but that was kind of like the poster child of highly produced, expensive podcasts. And I think, you know, you don't hear about it anymore if it is still going. And was it them? Someone was saying that They didn't say the number. I wish they would have said the number, but some huge percentage of podcasts only have one episode. I mean, is 20% a huge percentage? 80%? I don't know. I only know one person who made a podcast in real life, and they only did one episode. And it was like they took a... This is a lesbian woman, about 50 years old, and she took a class on... wasn't on social media, or it wasn't exactly on podcasting or social media, but it was some class on internet stuff. And so out of the, you know, 12-week or 9-week, whatever it is, class, that was what it culminated in, was them producing one podcast. And so she made that one, and it was a very strange one. It was about how, I mean, in not so many words, she's a lesbian because she was molested by a family friend when she was younger. I mean, it was all very personal stuff that I was unaware of. She never mentioned it in real life. And she was like, I was in love with you. I was a child. And I'm listening to this. I'm like, is that why you're a mega butch dyke? Well, none of you guys know who I'm talking about. So anyway, so this friend of mine, she's my friend because she was married to someone who is one of my real childhood friends who's a lesbian. And then they, like, I don't know if they went through the paperwork. Anyway, they broke up, maybe got a divorce, but they still live in the same house. And then they're dating other women, and then they're bringing the women home with them. So now it's a house full of broken up lesbians and their new girlfriends, and they're like yelling at each other. I mean, I don't know. It's just, anytime I ever break up with a person, well, two things happen. I never want to see them again, and I never do, or vice versa. Or, you know, we're getting back together. If we see each other, we're getting back together. But I guess lesbians do it different, right? You know, what's the joke? What does a lesbian bring on a first date? A U-Haul. The latest Glenn Cho podcast is talking about a new documentary called The Fall of Minneapolis. And I guess you can watch it on Rumble.com if you want. And it's about George Floyd. I guess, you know, what I would say is the murder of George Floyd. But apparently this movie has a bunch of police body cam footage that no one has seen heretofore. And it basically proves that the cops did not murder George Floyd. And so when John and Glenn, the two black guys on the Glenn Show, say that George Floyd was not murdered and the cops were railroaded and it was all a travesty of social justice, I believe him. The movie's an hour and a half, which, you know, thank God for shorter movies. I don't know if I'm going to watch it or not. And, you know, innocent people have their lives ruined for whatever reason. All, you know, every day, every hour, someone who's completely innocent in America gets completely screwed. And sounds like these cops were some of those kind of people. And of course, the end result is the murder of thousands and thousands of black people. You know, good cops are retiring, and then there's not enough cops, good or bad, left over to protect inner cities. And, you know, black people are just the victims of violent crime like crazy. But basically, none of that matters. You know, no amount of loss of black life matters. No amount of black lives being completely destroyed and their children having no parents and whole neighborhoods going to shit. None of that matters as long as some woke white people can pat themselves on the back and say they fought racism by railroading some cops. Well, no, they can't allow that last part. They're good. They fought racism. Don't talk about it ever again. Let's cover politics. The special counsel charged Hunter Biden with some tax crimes, maybe a few felonies, a few misdemeanors. And this is the same special counsel that tried to cut a deal with Hunter Biden that indemnified him from any future problems while giving him a slap on the wrist. So it's not clear if this is just another thing to help Hunter Biden out, so maybe he can take the fifth when he has to testify before Congress. Or maybe the special counsel is waking up to the fact that he's going to go down in history as a really corrupt special counsel if he doesn't charge Hunter with some stuff. And the House Republicans are back on the case and they're releasing new information. The latest thing was some company that Hunter Biden owned, they got millions of dollars from China, was writing checks to Joe Biden. It was small checks that said paying Joe Biden back for loaning Hunter money to buy a Ford Raptor truck. It's not a bombshell. It's a little more than a drip, 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 though. I think what's changed is NBC Nightly News ran a segment on Hunter Biden this week. NPR's news shows, they ran a thing on Hunter this week. I mean, there's already enough information out to crucify Joe Biden with his son Hunter if they just start telling all the true facts that we know in the past that they've been ignoring. I mean, they're not doing that yet, but I wonder if they're going to start helping with the investigation. I've said this before, but, you know, like Woodward and Bernstein are these really famous reporters who took down Richard Nixon and when he was doing Watergate and impeachment and stuff. And basically, you know, reporters at the New York Times, any of them could be the new Woodward and Bernstein and fucking bring down Joe Biden and get him impeached. Washington Post, anyway, any major mainstream media outlet, the reporters there could become the guy who brought down the corrupt president. I mean, basically, you can be one of 1,000 reporters who ignores obvious evidence and never writes about it, or you could be the one who, you know, shows bravery in times of trouble and is the one who writes about it, brings him down. Which, to me, it seems like it would be obvious. Someone would jump at that case. I mean, I guess whoever's in charge of the New York Times, etc., obviously would make it trouble, but anyways, something maybe happening, moving there. And then Tommy Tuberville is some sort of senator, and apparently the U.S. Senate has to confirm promotions in the military. I think it's just the high-up ones, like general and whatnot. But Senate rules allow one single senator to hold up all the promotions if they want. And so I think for 3 months he's been holding up promotions because the military is currently paying. If you're in the military and you want an abortion and you're in a state that doesn't allow abortion, then the military will pay for your travel expenses to go get one in another state. And so he said, as long as the military is doing that, I ain't doing no promotions. Anyways, he backed down and now the promotions are going through. And it may be because they were about to change the Senate rules. Like if he didn't back down, they're just going to change the rules and so he couldn't keep doing it. Or, you know, somehow pressure was applied to him. And I wish he had been holding up promotions based on all the diversity, equity, and inclusion and how the military is focusing on white rage and, you know, right-wing extremism is the number one threat to America today. But I wonder if people in the military see what he did and are like, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so woke, even though he did it over abortion and not general wokeness. And my theory on why the military got so woke was, you know, if you're a general, you get to retire after, I don't know, 25 years or something with a giant pension, and you're also a young man, and so you just go work for a arms manufacturer and, you know, make $500,000 a year because you know who to call at the military. You know, you got the phone numbers of the people to call at the military, so the arms manufacturers give you a job. And then arms manufacturers are owned by BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, so ESG applies to them too. And so that's why the military was getting woke, even though they wouldn't normally do that, is because they were all getting ready to go get cashed out civilian jobs after they retired from the military. And so, I don't know, ESG is getting, you know, less important in general, and maybe Tuberville doing this stuff will, hopefully the military will be less woke, maybe. They released a commercial, I don't know, like a month ago, that had, I think, a bunch of straight white men doing military stuff. You know, it just looked like a commercial from 80s, 90s, 2000s, any other decade than the past one. But their ads recently were getting very diverse and having a lot of But I think even sometimes having rainbow flags in them and whatnot. And then Ukraine, there's nothing in the war to talk about. Still a stalemate. But I guess the money that we give Ukraine is going to run out sometime, like end of this year or early next year. And so Joe Biden is asking the Republican House to give him $60 billion for the effort. And I mean, you know, they're all bought and paid. All the House Republicans are bought and paid for, just like every politician, by the military-industrial complex. But anyways, they're kind of putting up a fight because their voters do not agree. And so the current, I think they will pay the money and do nothing positive for the country. But anyways, what they're saying right now is they're only going to give the money if Joe Biden will sign a law that, changing asylum for, you know, illegal immigration. Like right now, anyone who can walk, you know, you take a step over the border into America, you say, I claim asylum. And then, I don't know, they put you on a bus to whatever city you want, and they tell you to call a phone number in 2 years, and you ignore that, and you're in. And I guess the deal would be to limit the number of asylum seekers, whatever, the number of people who can qualify for asylum each year, which would turn them back into the classic illegal immigrant thing that we had before. Like right now, we basically legalized it, make them illegal again. I don't think it would stop them from coming in. Joe Biden is still in control of what the people guarding the border do, which, you know, it's like, he's like, put your coat in a mud puddle if the immigrants have to walk over it. Well, the Israel-Hamas war has been going for over 2 months now, or at least 10-7, the attack that started it all is over 2 months ago. And I think, basically, we need another war. People are already starting to get bored on this one. I wish I'd been paying more attention. It seemed like the Ukraine war, I mean, it wasn't always the number one news story on every media outlet, but I think it was still in the news until this Israel-Hamas war, and then, I mean, it got booted off of the front, middle, back page, but NBC Nightly News is now leading each night with weather, you know, usually, I don't know, there was a storm in the south the other day, that was the first thing. So anyways, they're still doing a nightly thing about Israel, but it's not the first segment every day, so we're running through them a little bit fast. And I think Israel feels like they're winning the war. I mean, it's not really, you know, on one side is Israel, on the other side is Hamas. It's on one side is Israel, on the other side is, you know, all the woke politicians in Western countries. And apparently college students in America. So I think Israel is still winning, but, you know, we shall see. We did get some numbers. I think, let's see, Hamas reports the number of dead in Gaza. I mean, it's the Palestinian Health Authority, but it's just a wing of Hamas. But Israel said that the numbers that the health authority has been reporting are accurate. And I think when they said that, the health authority said there was 15,000 dead. And then the same week, Israel said that they had killed 5,000 combatants. Or, yeah, I think not militants, combatants. So if you put those two things together, then 5,000 out of 15,000 were military people killed, leaving 10,000 civilians, so 1 out of 3 are combatants, 2 out of 3 are civilians. And to me, that sounded pretty good. I mean, when Hamas is specifically trying to get you to kill civilians, when you kill them, I think, you know, 2/3 collateral damage, that seemed pretty good to me. The people I've been hearing it from, I haven't heard anyone go, wow, that's low, or wow, that's high. So I guess that's, they were not impressed. I was impressed by that number, you know, with Israel's ability to kill combatants. But other people seem to be, that's right in the zone where they're not happy, but they're not sad. I mean, I don't know what the average war is. You know, World War II, is it less than 1 out of 3? I don't know. More? I know America firebombed Dresden and Germany and Tokyo. Like, you know, did you ever wonder why we drop nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's because we had firebombed Tokyo. Like, it was way worse. Being firebombed is worse than being nuclear bombed, at least back then. I was listening to some podcast, and it was a pro-Palestinian guest was on, and I think there's 40,000 members of a Hamas, and this guy was like, you can't kill all of them. Like, if you killed every member of Hamas, then I think that would be a war crime. And I was like, you can't? Why not? I mean, seems like that's what you'd want to do. But, I mean, a lot of them are kids. You know, you start in Hamas at the age of 11 or something. And if you got all 40,000 of them with two civilians per combatant, 120,000, that'd be one in 20 of everyone in Gaza. I guess that would be too much. Well, I guess that would be too much. I'm not sure if that's too much for me, or, you know, maybe it is and I'm a monster, or I just haven't thought about it. But it seems like Israel is capturing Hamas people. There were some pictures of Hamas people down in, you know, they were wearing only their underwear. It's a whole bunch of men wearing only their underwear, maybe hands tied behind their backs. And that picture created outrage, like they're being mistreated. I mean, I don't know. They could have a weapon on them. They could have a bomb on them. But anyways, I think Israel is just arresting them and putting them into jail. And it's hard to tell a Hamas from a non-Hamas, you know, Palestinian man. And so I think if they can't tell, they put you into jail until the war is over. And I'm sure a lot of those guys are like, well, yeah, the other three guys, my three lifelong childhood buddies were all Hamas, but I'm not Hamas. How could you throw me in jail when you threw all four of us in jail? Or yeah, 99 out of the 100 people in that building were Hamas, but I was just delivering groceries. It is a travesty to throw me into jail. And they did some polling of Palestinians, and, you know, there's in Gaza, there's in the West Bank, there's Palestinians in general. And it seems like you basically get anywhere from 60 to 80% support for, you know, for Hamas, for fighting Israel, for destroying the country of Israel. So basically overwhelming support for any kind of question you can ask in that vein. And I think the Gazans are the one who supported a little less. So apparently a lot of bombing will make support go from 80 down to 60. And they broke it down by, like, you know, Hamas in Gaza, there's the people who are in charge of Gaza, like kind of like politicians. And then there's the military wing that, you know, goes in, that, well, went out into Israel and killed a bunch of people. And so the Gazans have a lot of support for the military wings. I haven't heard the numbers. I think they don't like the politicians. You know, I mean, they're corrupt. They don't, you know, they don't run it good. They're not picking up the garbage. They're not hiring good dog catchers. But as far as the military part that goes out and kills and rapes Israelis, that part of Hamas is real popular. I want to say like 88%. The December 2nd episode of the Slate Money podcast was talking about giving money to charity. And they have a British guy on. He was the president of Give Directly, all one word. It's like a charity that just gives cash. And he said some interesting things. Here's a clip.
Whereas if you say at a dinner party, what do you do? And you say, oh, I give people cash. You're slightly worried that they'll look at you like, whoa, you crazy? What do you mean you're just giving cash to people? Are you sure you didn't invent like an amazing roundabout in a playground, which is going to pump water when you sit on it or something?
This is a real example, by the way.
You know, it's a real example. It was an amazing thing. It's called the play pump. And a lot of the wealthiest people in the world decided that it was a really great idea to invest in this machine, which was a very expensive children's play item. So it's a roundabout. It's a thing that the child pushes and jumps on and it spins around. Okay. So they attached it to a water pump. And the idea is that while the children were spinning around, it would pump water for the village. Very, very expensive.
Child labor as a solution.
Buy, very expensive to maintain. Yeah. And of course, the children got bored. So then you end up with exhausted mothers pushing this damn thing round and round and round to try to get the water out of the pump.
So philanthropy is The idea should be to make the people you're donating money to feel good, but in practice it's to make the people donating the money feel good.
Yes, and I you know, that's understandable. I mean, I guess we all are weighing up our selfish instincts against our altruistic instincts. There's a lot of ego and our visions of ourselves involved and how we want to do our philanthropy. All that's very understandable.
So you can tell there's a lot of, it's kind of like woke virtue signaling BS going on with charities. It doesn't actually help people. I mean, if you went to the headquarters of some charity in New York City and went to the offices and looked at the people who were working there, my guess is that would probably be the wokest people on the planet. Like, they'd be more woke than, you know, Harvard professor teacher lounge. Actually, I don't know. I guess, you know, Harvard probably has little cliques of professors. So maybe if you found the Palestinian Black Lives Matter, you know, whatever group those teachers get into, maybe that'd be more woke. Anyways, it'd be pretty damn close. And if you count taking money from people and saying you're gonna help Black Africans and then not doing nothing so that money couldn't be spent in a more effective manner, if you count that as like destroying and killing Black lives, then I guess woke charities, once again, they're, you know, they think Black Lives Matter and they're killing Black people. I mean, the guy was saying, sounds like maybe just, you know, if you don't know anything about a charity, you would probably want to guess that 90% of the money goes to the people who work for the charity, you know, and their cars and their airplane flights and their rent, and 10% goes to the people they're supposedly helping. And charities are NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And NGOs like to get involved in rigging elections and, you know, hating Trump derangement syndrome. So it's not exactly the same thing. There's NGOs whose only thing is to turn Trump derangement, you know, to manifest Trump derangement syndrome into physical reality. And then there's charities who just take 90% of the money for themselves, give 10% to the poor people. You know, they do something similar. They manifest some Trump derangement syndrome into reality, not as much as one who's just dedicated to it. You know, NGOs whose whole purpose is to censor conservatives on social media, whatever. Well, that's just my boilerplate. So he said some interesting stuff about charity. And there's only a few kinds of charity that actually, you know, instead of 90% going to infrastructure of the charity itself, if you want to give 90% to the poor people, then there's only a few charities that will do that, and they are malaria, deworming, something else like that, I can't remember, and then straight cash. And malaria means giving anti-mosquito covered, whatever, chemically treated bed netting, I think, to people. I've heard stories about that. People, you know, Africans take their chemically treated bed netting that keeps the mosquitoes off while you sleep, and then they use it to go catch fish. I mean, you know, if you're going to starve to death tomorrow, that's more important than stopping malaria on your children. And hopefully the anti-malaria chemicals are non-toxic. Makes me want to start a malaria netting charity where the nets taste like chicken. Oh, right. The other thing was vaccination. Malaria, deworming, vaccination, direct cash. And then deworming, apparently poor kids in foreign countries have worms, so it's good to deworm them. Kind of like your dog. It's like, whatever happened to using tapeworms as a diet food or device? It seems like that would work, but you don't do it. I don't know. I mean, I heard that half of cats, pet cats, have tapeworms, or maybe whatever kind of worms cats get, and that worrying about your cat having worms is, don't worry about it. Half of all cats have them anyways. Now, more about worms. So there's something called hookworm. And that's where the stereotype of poor, stupid, redneck, white people in the South comes from, hookworms. Because you get it from walking barefoot through the muck, I think. Maybe fecal-infected muck. And then when you have hookworms, it makes you slow and foggy-headed. So the hillbilly on the front porch who's talking real slow, they probably have hookworm. And I think Southerners, you know, and it affects like your IQ and stuff. And it's like Southerners, I don't know when they started wearing shoes or something. Anyways, at some point in the South, I think they started wearing shoes. And all of a sudden, Southerners got a hell of a lot smarter. I think that was in the early part of the 1900s. And I'm sure the slaves were not given a lot of shoes either. So everyone in the South had it. So that's deworming, or what I know about worms. And then vaccination, whatever. I don't think they're talking COVID. Whatever you vaccinate the kids with in Africa. I guess not malaria if you still need the nets. And it seems like there's two kinds of people that charities want to help, which is girls in Afghanistan and then black Africa. I mean, I don't think the girls in Afghanistan are any worse off than the girls in black Africa, but it's famous. It's famously terrible for girls there, so they get a lot of money and time spent on them. So in 1980, there was 170 million super poor Africans. You know, it's always hard. Africans, I guess that would maybe include North Africa, but, you know, we're like the Arab, you know, part genetically European, part genetically Middle Eastern people are. I don't think they count. When charity people say Africa, they mean black Africa. So Africa had 170 million super poor people in 1980. They now have 470 million super poor people. And it's because the kids were dying before the age of five before. I guess, you know, the West has gone in there and been real nice and saved the kids, so that now there's 300 million extra incredibly poor people living miserable lives. The guy says that, you know, whatever the poor threshold is, I think it's maybe $2 a day. He says that it is nothing more miserable than trying to live, you know, at that poverty level. Like, these are not happy people, I don't know, wearing loincloths, running through the savannas, getting photographed topless by National Geographic. That was kind of a punch in the gut when I was a kid. It's like, oh, look, this National Geographic has topless women. Oh, never mind. Well, sometimes they did the same thing, but with Polynesian women. Anyway, I digress. So there's this thing, quality-adjusted life years. So you're trying to figure out how to quantify how much good a charity does. And you could say, you know, if you save someone's life, you know, if you save an 80-year-old's life, and they live one more year because they were going to die of something else anyways, then, you know, there's one life year. And then you got to adjust it for quality. It's like, they were in terrible pain for that one year that they lived. So anyways, saving someone one more year of life when they're in terrible pain, obviously this would be a low number on the quality adjusted life year thing. And there's no objective way to calculate this. It's just judgment call. And so, like, the example this guy gives, I don't know if this is how it works out, but he says, you could give money to 10 African villages, or for the same money, you could save the life of two babies in one of the villages. And now those babies are going to live a long time. You know, they might live to, I mean, it's looking like in the next 20 years, they're going to solve aging. But in any case, let's just say, you know, they live 60 years in Africa. So boom, you got 120 years off of saving those two babies. But then you got to adjust it for quality of life. And it's like those 10 shithole villages, everyone has a miserable life. The two babies who live 60 years have a miserable life. So it's a trade-off. Maybe you should just let those two babies die and just improve the life of everyone in those villages. And he doesn't say this, you know, but possibly if you, you know, basically he advocates just giving money directly. If you give money to those 10 villages, maybe they will become not quite such a shithole, and then the future babies won't die anyways. And there's this political correctness thing. Like, basically, what I'm about to say, I can say it about myself, but don't ever say it about black Africans. But what I'll say about myself is that if I'm not happy, if I don't enjoy my life, I don't want to be alive. I mean, America doesn't barely have any people with Down syndrome anymore because, well, they die young. So that's what happened to the ones who were born in the 80s and before. And then moms get their kids tested and they abort them. And there's other stuff worse than Down syndrome. So it's like, you know, if you're going to have a kid, do you want to basically waste it on a kid with, you know, terrible birth defects or something? Or maybe even beyond that, if it's a kid, you know, a kid with terrible defects or just no kid at all, maybe no kid is better. And then you take that to the extreme and it's like kids growing up in Africa in terrible poverty and, you know, the girls all getting raped by 20 men before they're a teenager and the boys, you know, hacking each other up with machetes. It's like, maybe they shouldn't have been born. Maybe you should have less people who can enjoy their lives. There's something called carrying capacity. Well, so the thing I always think about is the Indiana Jones, the original Raiders of the Lost Ark. In that movie, he goes to Egypt, and except for the Egyptians who are on the side of the Nazis trying to kill him, it's a real nice place. Everyone he meets is real nice. It's really fun. They got, you know, exotic cuisine that's wonderful. They sing and they laugh and they dance. And basically, Egypt in, I don't know, 1940 was just a wonderful place to visit. And now you go to Egypt and it's like dangerous and terrible. And the same thing happened with Black Africa. You know, as long as you didn't get dysentery from drinking the water or something, you know, if you went on vacation in Africa in, I don't know, probably, you probably wanted to do it before the end of World War II. Anyways, before 1957, that was when they started getting independence. Ghana was the first country to get independence from Britain in 57. So if you went to Africa in 56, you could travel from country to country and just see, you know, different amazing people and cultures and cuisine, and it would just be awesome. You know, go hang out with the Pygmies, hang out with the Zulus. Some king wants to give you his daughter. You're like, I think I'm going to the next country. But anyways, that's all before the white man messed with the carrying capacity of Africa. So carrying capacity is how many people can live on a chunk of land, like a whole country. You know, like, you know, how much can the farming support? It's like, oh, the farm, you know, the farms in this country can support 1 million people. And that would be the carrying capacity. And anytime the moms tried to have more kids to go above a million, well, there wasn't enough food to go around. It kept you right at a million. And the carrying capacity works for all animals, you know. Like around me, I got tons of deer. Apparently, humanity comes in, all the predators are gone, and the carrying capacity of the deer is through the roof. Rats with antlers. But so it was a couple Germans, Haber and Bosch. I think Haber was a Jew. Anyways, they created the Haber-Bosch process, which takes nitrogen out of the air, creates ammonia, and somehow, you know, and science, something, something, nitrogen equals fertilizer. Boom. All across the world, we had tons of food, and you could throw the carrying capacity for humans out the window. And, you know, obviously any single baby dying before the age of 5 is a tragedy, but it turns out when you keep them all alive, or tons and tons and million, you know, 300 million of them, apparently, since 1980, it just turns all those countries into shitholes and makes those countries suck and ruins the quality of life. You know, and so I'm sure when they do their quality of life year calculation, they're putting a whole bunch of emphasis on being alive and not very much on how nice a country it is for the people who live there and, hey, people who want to visit. But so the guy tells some stories, like that clip about the merry-go-round that the women now have to push. And I think he was in charge of helping Africa for the UK government at one point. And so they set up a program. They allocated $40,000 per African village to try and get clean water to girls in school because they were having to drop out because they were getting their periods. And the idea was if they can wash up when they're bleeding down there, then they will stay in school. And so he went to go see, check on what the $40,000 was buying. And he pulls up to a school and there's a whole bunch of white Range Rovers there. That's apparently what charity people in Africa drive. And they had dug a couple holes in the ground, lined them with bricks. I assume there was water at the bottom. And there was 5 red 5-gallon buckets there. And it cost $38,000 of the $40,000 for the engineers to discuss it and the people to oversee that the money wasn't stolen. Apparently a lot of it is, basically it cost $38,000 to dig a couple wells to make sure the money wasn't stolen. And then $2,000 to dig the actual well. And so this guy, and they're like, well, why don't you just give $2,000 to the teacher in charge of the school? And they're like, well, he might steal it. And he's like, you guys just stole $38,000. But kind of like in that clip, it's, you know, apparently giving money to charity is not, it's not really about helping people. It's about doing something fun. It's fun to give money to charity and fantasize about how you're, you know, feeding some kid in Africa for a dollar a day. But it just wastes a bunch of money. And so, I mean, they've been talking about this for a while where you just give money directly. And I guess at this point it has now been proven that is the way to go. And he was given the example, like you got your African village and like, you know, one person has a hole in the roof, so they need a new roof. Another person has a daughter who's right about to go to school age, but they can't afford school. Someone else wants to start whatever kind of small business you start in an African village. And so you could send an engineer to every house to look at all their roofs, and you could send a social worker to go around and evaluate all the children, etc. I guess one of the big things they've been wasting money on is youth business classes. You teach the young kids all the jargon for business and then hope that they start a business, but in fact they don't start any businesses. Or you can just give everyone in the village some money, and the person who has a hole in the roof, they call their cousin to come fix it. The person who kids are about the school age, well, they just pay for school. And then teaching persons about business doesn't help them start a business. They need money. They need capital to start their business. But then, you know, if you're a 50-year-old white woman in New York, just giving money, that's not that fun. And it doesn't get to, you know, it doesn't give you a job. You're not hanging out with your Trump-deranged friends talking about your charity work. If you work for the NGO or you just talk to the people at the NGO, maybe you're doing dinners to raise funds for the NGO. Anyways, all that fun stuff goes out the window. You just write a check and then there's nothing to talk about, nothing to do. And all of this probably wasn't possible in the past. I don't think they could have done a study on this in the 60s and found out, oh, just give money directly. And then, you know, we could have been doing it since 1970 till today. Because the way they give money is with cell phones, and in particular, the SIM card. Right now, one of my friends is like, she's an 80-year-old lady and she's having phone problems, and I've been having to take the back off her phone and take out the SIM card and put it in another phone and troubleshoot. And if you don't know, a SIM card is, it's just a little computer chip looking thing that you can take in and out of your cell phone. And it kind of like holds your phone number. When you buy a new cell phone, depending on if you're locked into a Verizon thing or if you got a more lenient cell plan, you can just take the SIM card out and put it into a different phone that you bought on Amazon. But so in Africa, I guess the SIM card is tied to a phone number. It's tied to a bank account. And so basically every SIM card equals a bank account for a poor African. And I think Give Directly, the charity that he was, he left his position so that a black person could be in charge of the whole thing. We'll see how well that goes. But anyways, while he was in charge of it, I think 93 cents on the dollar just went directly to SIM cards. And it's not perfect. He was mentioning the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. This is a landlocked country in the middle of Africa that is quite possibly the worst shithole on the planet. And I think, like, if you count the difference between one person's DNA and another person's DNA, the difference between them kind of like as possibly being a different race, then that country in particular has like 30 or 40 different races in it, all of them who are more different than a Chinese person is from a Swedish person. And basically, they got different races, they got different tribes, apparently they have 100 different armies, like little militias, big armies. I don't know if they're Muslim or not. They probably are a mixture of religions. Anyways, they really go to town with AK-47s and machetes there. And, I don't know, some number of millions of the people in the Congo have had to leave whatever village it was they lived in and go somewhere else because they got the boot, but they didn't leave the country. They're still in the same country, but they can't live where they lived. They're refugees. I'm sure they would all like to move to Europe, but the country is so backwards, they don't even do that. But he's saying, so they give Africans money on their SIM cards, on their cell phones, but they decided in the Congo, this place is so dangerous that asking them to go, okay, so you have to activate your SIM card. So you have to like go to the cell phone store, whatever that looks like in the Congo. You have to go to the cell phone store in the big city to get your phone activated so that you can, or your SIM card activated so that you can get money. And they said these roads are, you know, they're too long and they're too dangerous. So they said, okay, the local charity workers can take all the people's SIM cards, take them to the city, get them activated, and go give them to the poor African people individually. And of course, surprise, surprise, those people just kept all the SIM cards and kept all the money. And I guess to their credit, this Give Directly charity, instead of like hiding this up and saying, oh, we wasted your money, or, you know, and being afraid to say we wasted money, they publicized it. They said, hey, every charity out there, listen to us. If you do what we did in the Congo, you're going to get ripped off. You're going to waste your money, so don't do that. So that's good. And the guy was saying, the problem with charities, it kind of comes down to that proverb where give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man a fish, to fish, he eats for a lifetime. I don't know if that's a Christian thing, or it's definitely like it's a white thing you hear when you're a kid. But anyways, like I say, apparently teaching Africans stuff doesn't work. They may actually even learn the thing that you were trying to teach them, but if they ain't got no money, they can't implement it, so it gets you nowhere. So that's why it's better to just give the money straight across. And then he was saying, I don't know, just a fun little story related to that clip. It's like, you know, you're at your fancy New York cocktail party. You want to talk about all the charity and the Africans you're helping. And you don't want to just be like, oh, I gave a bunch of money directly to them. End of story. Let's talk about something else. You want to be like, oh, I'm such a genius. Like, I had this epiphany. If you give someone a chicken, then the chicken produces eggs. And then those eggs produce more chickens. In a few generations, they're swimming in chickens. I was talking to someone about the term neurodivergent. Like, young people on social media will put that in their bios. You know, be like, went to this college, they, them pronouns, neurodivergent. So I looked it up. Here's a little bit from Wikipedia. Their article is called Neurodiversity, which I believe is neurodivergence is part of that. So neurodiversity. It argues that diversity in human cognition classified as mental disorders are differences and not pathological. The framework grew out of the autism rights movement and builds on the social model of disability, arguing that disability partly arises from societal barriers, rather than attributing disability purely to inherent deficits. It instead situates human cognitive variation in the context of biodiversity and the politics of minority groups. Anyways, it goes on and on like that. Bit more. The neurodiversity paradigm has been controversial amongst disability advocates, with opponents arguing it risks downplaying the suffering associated with some disabilities and that it calls for the acceptance of things some would wish to be treated. Anyways, neurodivergent, neurodiversity, it's a stolen valor thing. It's for young white women who are racist against whites and don't want to be classified as a white. They want to be part of a minority group. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with them other than, you know, they're woke. and we're not currently allowing people to self-identify as black. I mean, that's, I'll tell you, if you just let young white girls self-identify as black, they would all self-identify as black and we could all move on. But anyways, that one's not allowed, so they got to do other things. So this is where you identify as being disabled, even when you're not. Get some of that stolen valor. So it's like pronouns, you know. Pronouns, you get to pretend that you're gay and get some of that oppressed group oppression Olympics points. And then, you know, maybe you can steal some, I mean, you know, mentally ill. It's a hard thing to prove. I mean, it used to, back in my day when you were mentally ill, you hid that from people and tried to act sane. But now you go on social media and make up mental illnesses you don't have. Anyways, neurodivergent, keep an eye out for it. I mean, I think it's already, I feel like, you know, a year ago was the height of neurodivergence talk, but I will say, when I record these segments, I then have to name the file, and I use speech-to-text with my phone, and I was like, I said, that last segment, I named it Neurodivergent Part 1, and I was like, is Android and Google going to know the word neurodivergent? And the answer was, oh yeah, it knew it perfectly. And this part you're listening to right now is about to be in a file called Neurodivergent Part 2. I'm listening to a recent The Glenn Show podcast, and he has on Eric Smith. And so it's a couple of non-woke black guys talking. And I think they're both Ivy League professors. This Eric Smith guy, he says that there is descriptive racism and prescriptive racism. And I don't know if it's true, but that's interesting. So I believe in the descriptive model of language, not the prescriptive one. And so with language, like, you know, what does a word mean? Well, in the descriptive model, then whatever, however people use a word, whatever, you know, actual way that people talk, then that's what the word means. If people all around the world are saying that, you know, dog, D-O-G, means a four-legged feline, then it does. And that's descriptive. Now, prescriptive says, no, I don't care what the people are using the word and how, we'll tell you what it means. You know, you look it up in the dictionary, D-O-G, dog, means a four-legged canine. And that's obviously a ridiculous example, but there's tons of words that, like, you know, it takes a long time to get in the dictionary. I don't know, like, you know, for instance, like bad, which means good sometimes. Like a Michael Jackson has an album called Bad, and he meant, you know, I'm bad, badass, I'm good, I'm awesome. Like, you know, that super fast car, that thing is bad. I'm making this podcast and I'm like, do people know that bad means good sometimes? I think my listeners know that. The question of whether or not my listeners are aware of that is sucking up way more mental effort than it should. Anyways, so descriptive means however people use the language, that's what words mean. Prescriptive means, you know, kind of the official definition, that's what words mean. And so I don't know about racism, but he says descriptive racism is, you know, as an example, thinking that black people are inferior. And prescriptive racism is black people need to think a certain way. Like, you know, you can't be a conservative, you can't vote for Trump. And so I don't know if that's true or, anyways, it's just something he said. Is there two kinds of racism? Something I'm thinking about and I don't know. Let's try it against whites. So descriptive anti-white racism would be, whites are evil colonizers. They're all evil from the moment they're born and the doctor spanks them on the butt to get them to breathe. But then what would prescriptive anti-white racism be? Would that be, you have to be woke? You have to hate Trump? Or would descriptive racism be, you have to be a racist conservative who votes for Trump? Or is it that classic thing that white people can be whatever they want and black people have to be a certain way? In which case, prescriptive anti-white racism doesn't exist? Well, he says if, you know, prescriptive racism against blacks is if you don't behave a certain way, then you're not authentically black, which There is no authentic version of whiteness. It probably is an authentic version of whiteness. There's no authentically white. Well, I don't think I'm going to be using prescriptive racism when I'm talking, but let's be a little racist. It's definitely like black guys out there who have a way with words, and it sounds good. I mean, I don't mean it sounds good, but it's bad. It's kind of a cool wordsmithy thing to say. But then they're talking about DEI and affirmative action. And he's talking about some black female professor where she is being forced by higher ups at her school to give black students better grades than they deserve. I mean, I don't know. He doesn't explain exactly what happened to her. You know, maybe you stop giving out grades and you just do pass-fail. Kind of like how colleges are getting rid of the SAT, or it's optional. That's usually what you do. You don't actually go in and change the grades of people based on race specifically. But you do have different cutoffs on admissions for SAT scores. Anyways, I'm not trying to rehash that thing. But he's talking about some woke black professor who apparently has said, you know, the reason why you have different criteria for black students so that they get through college, even when they, you know, are not held to the same standards and therefore head off into life not prepared. Well, the reason to do all that is so that they will be alienated, you know, when they're out in the world. They'll be upset. They'll be unhappy. They'll think that stuff ain't right. And then when people are alienated, it's easier to get them over to your cause. If your cause is everything's messed up and we got to tear it down. You know, we don't need to make slight changes and fix America. We need to burn it all. We need to tear it all down. And I would have said, that's just one professor. I didn't even hear his exact wording. And even if he believes exactly that, who cares? But it plays along with the effective accelerationism I was talking about the other week. I think you just call it accelerationism. If you want to make fun of it, you call it effective accelerationism. But that people, you know, pro-technology people and then Marxists, both might favor, some of them favor accelerationism, which is the idea that we need to go full speed ahead on artificial intelligence until it takes away everyone's jobs and the world is turned on its head. And, you know, there's two motives for it. One of them is like, well, we need to get through it real fast where everyone loses their jobs, because on the other side of that is Star Trek abundance where everything is free. You know, you have a machine that'll make, you know, whatever you tell the machine. You have a magic 3D printer that'll print out anything you tell it for free. So that's kind of the technology is good side. And then the other side is that we need everyone to lose their jobs, you know, because the world is America and the world is currently intolerable. And the way to get everyone to agree, the proletariat, to agree to tear everything down is they all need to lose their jobs. And then they'll be pissed off enough that we can destroy the world and then build it anew in a, you know, Marxist paradise. So I don't really go along with either one of those ideas. The fact that you can want the same thing, which is full speed ahead on artificial intelligence and technology, you know, both sides, the farthest to the left and not exactly the farthest to the right, but whatever, the most pro-technology and the most anti-everything both have the same result, which is full speed ahead, makes me think that those are not good reasons for full speed ahead. Or more likely, one of those reasons is totally wrong. But anyways, something to keep an eye out on. I'm hearing more and more people talk about we're getting to the end of whatever and then something new is coming and possibly we got to tear it all down and build anew. Slate Money is talking about self-checkout at the store, and they're saying that 4% of stuff that people take home they don't pay for, and it's not on purpose, it's just by accident. They thought they scanned it or they scanned it wrong or something. So it's funny because stores are like, you know, it's kind of like stealing it. You can steal 4%, the equivalent of that. That's fine. It's better than paying a worker. And I think some people like self-checkout, some people don't. For me, I mean, the only time I go to the store is a huge amount of vegetables and alcohol. And those are the things that make self-checkout a nightmare. They don't give you enough room. You always have to get a worker. I guess some people go in and just buy a couple little things that can be scanned, and they walk in the store and they walk out of the store, but I do that kind of stuff online, so it doesn't apply to me. If you like self-checkout, that's fine. And apparently, to make grocery shopping self-checkout not a nightmare, some places have a scanner and a computer built into your shopping cart, so you just zap each apple as you go. That sounds kind of cool. And they're saying, yeah, one of the problems for self-checkout is, like, people don't know which apple they have. I know I don't. I bought a bunch of apples. I bought a big bag of apples. What I know to do with apples now is you squeeze a bunch of the apples in the bag and make sure that they're still firm so you don't get the mealy-mouthed ones. But it can't tell you if they're going to be sweet. You want them firm and sweet. And I got screwed again. Because I've been making caramel apples. And I was like, well, if you put a bunch of caramel on your apple, who cares what the apple tastes like? It turns out it's very important that the apple be good also. Well, that's the end of the episode. Social media links in the description. Also a link to the George Floyd movie. Thanks for listening.